We will now proceed to our second paper from Professor Rukmini from Concordia University in Canada. Do you need a glass of water?
I got it. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I know.
The title of Professor Rukmini's paper is Hindu Sannyasins in the Temple Context.
Okay. Since we don't have... Thank you, Patrick. I'll join the club. No visuals. So I leave out my preliminaries. So I'm really going to talk about the Advaita Vedanta Sampradaya Sannyasins. How do they reconcile their activities in temples? So, of course, temples are very important in the Hindu religious tradition, and it is therefore not surprising that the sannyasins also do not devalue the importance of these places of worship and do not decline to participate in the ceremonial activities that take place within the temple precincts. But this can pose some predicaments for sannyasins belonging to the Advaita Vedanta Sampradaya because of the opposition between ritual karma and knowledge, jnana karma samachaya, that is at the root of Advaita Vedanta philosophy. Thus, what I would like to see is whether one can find spaces within the Advaita school of philosophy for activities both within the temple and those connected with the temple. I look at the Upanishad commentaries of Shankaracharya, in particular the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, hagiographical material available regarding Shankara's life, as well as the various interpretative devices like Loka Sangraha that the sannyasins used to justify their participation in these activities. I deal with the sannyasin of the Advaita Vedanta Sampradaya alone for a couple of reasons. It is only the Advaita Sampradaya associated with Shankara that opposes strictly the combination of ritual and knowledge for the sake of attainment of moksha. The Vaishnava Sampradayas have no such opposition. In fact, they support rituals for all, including their sannyasins. Thus, apart from Advaita's clear-cut statement about avoiding rituals, which naturally implies temple ritual, the establishment of ashramas or mathas in Hinduism is traditionally also associated with Shankaracharya, and the others in general set themselves as either following the Advaita model or as deviating from it. Secondly, there are available some published material regarding Shankara in the Advaita Sampradaya to undertake a study of this nature, even though they are in the form of hagiographical texts. I use both matha and ashrama in this paper when I specifically talk about the Shankara mathas, as both these words are used in popular usage. In this context, it is good to remind ourselves that sannyasins in general need not stay in the matha they belong to, and they are free to go out and in turn give initiation to others who are fit for sannyasa. Thus, the institution of sannyasa is not confined to those staying within the four or five mathas that are associated with Shankaracharya. There are many like Swami Bhumananda, Swami Dayananda Saraswati, and others who, though belonging to the Advaita Vedanta Sampradaya, are out on their own, following the rules and regulations of the system and running their own ashramas. Therefore, what they do in their lives as sannyasins is also interpreted as what is allowed for sannyasins of the Advaita system. It is understood that even if these sannyasins work outside the precincts of the parent matha, they try not to deviate too much from the main teachings of what sannyasa dharma really means. Of course, these dharma rules are always subject to interpretation, both generally and specifically within a local context, and one can imagine that swamis like Swami Bhumananda somehow interpret the rules of the sampradaya depending on the local context. The only systematic text that deals with the rules and regulations of sannyasins is the Yadi Dharma Samuchaya, translated by Olivet. As he mentions, there are clear indications that this text is written from a Vaishnava standpoint. However, on the question of temples, in the Yati Dharma Samuchaya states nothing that is at variance with the Advaita standpoint. Thus, the few references in this work mention temples as a place to be visited before one renounces, i.e., it is part of the procedure of renunciation, as a place where the sannyasin can sit for meditation after renunciation, or as a place he can spend the night in, but nowhere as a place where he can perform rituals or worship. The Jivan Mukti Viveka of Vidyaranya, I've skipped a few other references, which is from the Advaita Vedanta point of view, also says clearly in the Manonasha Prakaranam that even visits to temples by sannyasins for worship has to be stopped. So even though Ramanuja's example in the Vaishnava tradition may be in favor of continuing performing ritualistic actions in a temple even after the adoption of sannyasa, that is clearly forbidden in the Advaita tradition. But in truth, almost all the Advaita Acharyas, including the Shankaracharyas, do visit temples or worship at temples built in the premises of their ashrama itself. There is thus a disjunction between what the textual formulation is with regards to ritual and what is actually practiced both within and without the Shankaracharya mathas by Advaita sannyasins. During a visit to Rameshwaram in 2000 CE to try to meet Swami Jayendra Saraswati of the Kanchi Matha, I was told that Swami's first priority is to visit the Rameshwaram temple before any of his other activities. That remains as a tradition even today. So much for Vidyaranya's prohibition. Of course, it is not a vidhi like that of a Mimamsa vidhi, which is binding, but can it be explained away in the light of Shankaracharya's own prohibition of the combination of jnana and karma is a moot question. Let us look at some other examples of Advaita sannyasins today. Swami Bhumananda initiated as a sannyasin in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta and who is the head of the Narayanashrama Tapovanam in Kerala is well known for his crusade against derogatory and illegal practices in temples than with his spiritual enlightenment, says the June 2007 issue of Vichara Setu, which is a newsletter of the ashrama itself. Furthermore, Swami Bhumananda spearheaded the movement of stopping the performance of obscene singing at the Kodungallur Bhagavati temple. He was also responsible in large measure for correcting the criminal practice of Thukam at the goddess of Eravur Puttangau. He was again personally responsible for renovating and reconstructing many temples following strict ritualistic ceremonies. Thus, while he himself may not have done the rituals himself, his presence at all these ritualistic activities certainly violates the spirit behind the injunction of prohibiting sannyasins from being part of any ritualistic action. In his 50 years of sannyasa, Swami Bhumananda has spent a large part of his life within temples, reforming temple activities, as well as being behind the reconstruction and renovation of temples. He also distributes sewing machines to indigent women and feeds the old and incapacitated, all of which do not fit into the Advaita image. He reconciles his temple-related activity and other social activities under the concept of Loka Sangraha. I shall examine this interpretation a little later in the paper. It will also be interesting to look at one of the mathas established by Shankaracharya himself and see if one can find legitimacy for the actions of swamis like Swami Bhumananda, for instance. I therefore look at the Sringeri Matha and the life of the head Shankaracharya at that matha and who is addressed as the Jagat Guru by his followers, as can be understood from the Madhava Digvijay. Jagat Guru is the title given to Shankaracharya himself by all the hagiographies, and it is also given to all successive Shankaracharyas of the mathas as well. The life of the sannyasins and the head sannyasin is modeled after the life of Shankaracharya as described in these various hagiographies. In the Advaita tradition, which I'm sure will be true for the other sampradayas as well, the sannyasins who reside in the mathas established by Shankaracharya hold a special appeal in the hearts of the followers, and the mathas themselves are pilgrimage centers where religious and spiritual minded devotees throng to get a glimpse of the head Shankaracharya. He holds a strong appeal to the devotees who even consider him to be the reincarnation of Shankara himself. In keeping with the anti-ritual stand of Shankaracharya, one would expect to see the head Shankaracharya at least not participate in any ritual of any kind. But that is not what happens there. on a visit to Sringeri in 2000 CE, I myself was witness to the Shankaracharya of Sringeri performing puja to Chandramaulishwara and Sharadamba. Savai and Chekna also confirmed this practice based on their field studies. Savai also observes that when the Jagadguru worships Sharadamba, the doors of the temple are closed, for the lay smarthas are not permitted to see the Jagadguru prostrating himself before deities. One can wonder as to why the doors would be closed. Would it be an acknowledgement of the conduct of the Jagadguru being contradictory to Shankaracharya's instructions? I argue that a part of the problem is the way in which the institution of sannyasa evolved in Hinduism. Even though the sannyasashrama was in place by the 4th century BC, as Patrick says, the concept, and also Hiranya, the concept of sannyasa itself was not clearly demarcated as having a preliminary and secondary stages, like vanaprastha and sannyasa. How and when did the 4th ashrama itself come into being in the Hindu tradition has had no definite answer to date. Following Hiranya, one could say that the period between 500 BCE to 500 CE saw a number of changes taking place both within society and generally in all ways of thought. Even though the contrast between the brahmachari and grihastha is well defined in Vedic times, that is not so with regard to the 4 ashramas and also between the vanaprasthin and the sannyasin, which are later developments. There is no uniform view as to when and how the 4 ashramas came to be part of Hindu dharma. I leave out a lot of the evolution. Let us look at Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 3.5.1 and 4.4.22. Anybody studying sannyasa has to look at these two, where there is a twofold division of spiritual seekers and an attempt to describe them. To the first category belong those who perform rituals in the right way without desires for other worlds, and they are contrasted with that of the renouncers who renounce all desires, like that of sons, putraishana, vittaishana, and lokaishana. This second kind is a renouncer or a sannyasin who lives by begging for alms. It will be noticed that of the two kinds of sages described here, one is still within the ritual fold who can reach the world of maybe Hiranyagarbha or Brahman by staying within the ritual world, and the other, the stage of a renouncer who renounces everything and wanders begging for alms. It is not that the sannyasa or renouncer stage itself is being divided into two, but the whole search for truth is viewed as both within the world following the prescribed ritual and another by completely renouncing the ritual world. Similarly, if we examine Chandogya 2.23.1, there is mentioned only the state of the Brahma Samstaha, who attains immortality, Amritatvameti, who's contrasted with the other three who attain the other worlds. In these passages, we do come across some significant words like avidvat and viditsita, vividishanti, etc., which can remotely suggest the twofold vanaprastha and sannyasa stages, though Shankara does not use those specific terms in this context. But he does use the word vidvamsaha and approvingly of vividisha in many places in his Brahma Sutra Bhashya. The later formulation of the vanaprasthin as continuing a ritual life in the forest in the company of his wife does recall to mind these early attempts to separate one type of seeker from the complete renouncer. What then is the stand that Shankara takes regarding the vanaprasthin? Shankaracharya uses the specific term vanaprastha in a couple of places in his commentary, Brahma Sutra Bhashya, and he also argues for the 3.4.49 and 3.4.20, and he also argues that the Upanishads do refer to all the 4 ashramas and the vanaprastha by allusion, Chandogya, Brihadaranyaka, etc. There is a specific reference to vanaprastha in Shankara's commentary on Mundaka Upanishad 2.1.2.11. Even so, we do not get any further help from Shankara's works to add to whatever we already know from the Upanishads regarding the development of a separate stage of sannyasin known as a vanaprasthin. Our earlier references from the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya place the one in the forest, vanaprasthin, within the ritual fold and is distinctly different from the sannyasin according to Shankara. Thus, the way in which the sannyasa stage itself came to be divided into a stage of the vanaprasthin and the sannyasin is rather murky. When the origins of an institution like that of sannyasa itself is complex, there are possibilities of many changes taking place as time goes by. It is possible that gradually the possibility of someone like a vanaprastan living in the forest and being allowed to continue his ritual activity for attaining the world of Brahma gradually, Krama Mukti, could have somehow brought rituals into the lifestyle of a sannyasin in course of time. That changes do take place within institutions is amply illustrated by the further changes that the sannyasa ashrama underwent in medieval times. Not only sannyasa, but even karma underwent so many changes as we see amply illustrated in the Bhagavad Gita. Karma by the time of the Gita is increasingly defined as nishkama karma and stands on par with sannyasa for the attainment of moksha. Thus, when karma itself can no more be defined as ritual karma, the significance of the twofold division in the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, based on ritual activity we referred to earlier, can no more clearly distinguish a sannyasin from the other type. Thus, when the Gita redefines a sannyasin, equating him with a yogi in chapter 6.1, and not with one who does not maintain a ritual fire, Niragnihi, it is indeed a radical change, perhaps fitting the times. In a similar manner, the description of who qualifies to be called a sannyasin underwent a number of changes in the medieval period, especially one can say after the advent of Ramanuja. In Ramanuja's understanding of sannyasa, there was no opposition between managing the affairs of a temple and continuing the practice of Vaishnavism, as he himself spent his entire sannyasa life managing the affairs of the Srirangam temple. It is possible to conjecture that this behavior on the part of Ramanuja could have also influenced the Advaitins to rethink their classification of the institution of sannyasa. It is significant that it is during the medieval times that we come across the division of the sannyasins of the Advaita school into four types called the Kutichaka, Bahudaka, Hamsa and Paramahamsa. Shankaracharya only uses the term Paramahamsa to clearly distinguish the one who truly knows from the followers of a ritualistic life and not as one of the divisions of the sannyasins themselves. The ritual follower, also called a Vividishu or a Vividisha sannyasin, is contrasted with the Vidvat sannyasin, who is the renouncer of the Brihadaranyaka. One can infer that these terms, Kutichaka, etc., became popular during the medieval times, since the Amarakosha does not refer to them and Shankara also does not talk about them. Vidyaranya significantly remarks that the fourfold division, Kutichaka, etc., is explained in the Puranas, thus suggesting that it was a later development. It is well known how the Puranas have sought to explain many an ancient difficult concept in common parlance, and this is no exception. The only way we can reconcile all these divisions is that the sannyasin, being very much part of society in the Hindu fold, was subject to the changing conditions in society itself, and in turn some adjustments were made to the institution of sannyasa itself. The desire for moksha is part of the Hindu psyche, even today, but the rigorous lifestyle of a sannyasin is not everyone's cup of tea. Thus, it is possible to suggest that the various divisions of sannyasins was the accommodation to the spiritual aspiration of moksha combined with the less and less rigorous forms of sannyasa. There is a gradation of excellence among the four sannyasins called Kutichaka, etc. We already saw that Shankaracharya was an advocate of Paramahamsa as the most excellent sannyasin, clubbing the others under the ritual sphere. The fourfold division in Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, though meant to distinguish between the lesser kind of detached individuals from the Paramahamsa one, could very well have gradually led to the fourfold sannyasins like the Kutichaka, etc. The Kutichaka, Bahutaka, Hamsa and Paramahamsa are described in terms of Vairagya, getting stronger and stronger progressively in an individual. While in the face of personal tragedy, one forms a detachment to the world called as Shmashana Vairagya in common parlance, only that resolve not to possess children, wealth or success in the world is classified as strong detachment by Vidyaranya, and the Kutichaka and others are of Tivra Vairagya, that is strong detached people. He classifies the four Kutichaka, etc., as inferior and superior in an ascending order depending on their Vairagya. The Ashrama Upanishad mentions that the Kutichakas are those who beg for alms from their own sons and relatives and stay isolated near the family. This refers to their inability to travel due to health reasons. This finds support from Vidyaranya, who also divides them as those fit to travel and those due to circumstances not fit to travel, the former called a Bahudaka and the latter a kutichaka. But both these are relegated to an inferior status as they are called tridandins, possessing three staffs. As the Advaita school privileges the ekadandin, this immediately indicates the inferior status accorded to these two in the hierarchy. Further, in the superior kind of detachment, again, there are two divisions called the Hamsa and the Paramahamsa. The Hamsa gets gradual moksha, kramamukti, in another world, whereas the Paramahamsa achieves moksha in this world itself, jivan mukta. Fully aware of the dynamics of change in society, Vedic hermeneutics prescribes certain rules to accommodate contradictory or contrary positions. Niyamavidhi is one such rule which Oliver uses to justify the rules and regulations of a sannyasin's life in general. We could also consider all these various divisions of sannyasins as coming under a sort of niyamavidhi, namely a restrictive injunction. Thus, in general, sannyasins have to be paramahamsa, but at a minimum, they should have vairagya. So if vairagya is there, niyama, then they can be included in the list of sannyasins, albeit in a lower category. Once this was allowed, it is possible to also include ritual activity within the understanding of who a sannyasin is by making a further category of whether the sannyasin is directly participating in the ritual itself or is just acting indirectly to further the welfare of society at large. Thus, in spite of the prohibition of rituals, they have been introduced through the back door by only euphemistically avoiding fire ritual, niragni, and allowing other kinds of ritual. If the origin of the sannyasa ashrama is complex and therefore permitted the changes to come within its fold, the life of Shankaracharya, as presented in the hagiographical accounts, also does not separate his life as a sannyasin from certain ritualistic activities that come very much within the domain of rituals. The life history of Shankara, given in the Shankara Digvijaya of Madhava, mentions that Shankaracharya installed the images of Sharada and perpetuated the worship of Sharadamba in Sringeri. He is also credited to have placed the Sri Chakra both at Sringeri and Kanchi, as claimed by the followers of these mathas. Savai, who has researched the Sringeri matha in great detail, thus summarizes what is stated in the various hagiographies regarding Shankara's religious activities. I quote, "Below the image of Sharada, Shankara is said to have placed a Sri Chakra, which he himself had inscribed on stone. While he stayed in Sringeri, Shankara is stated to have inaugurated the worship of a Spatika Linga of Chandramaulishwara and a Murti of Ganapati carved out of a block of crystal with a ruby in the middle. Shankara is believed to have installed four guardian deities for the protection of Sharada," unquote. The installation of the four deities is sometimes attributed to Vidyaranya, the 11th Jagadguru of the Sringeri Matha as well. The Sringeri Matha is thus associated in history not only with preserving the Advaita philosophical heritage and being an abode for sannyasins, but also as being a site for the worship of Sharada. Other Shankara Mathas also share a similar history. Thus, tradition believes that Shankara installed crystal images at Chidambaram, Kedara, Nepal, and Kanchi. He is also credited to have retrieved the Narayana image from the Alakananda River and installed it at Badari, where even today a Nambudri priest performs the puja. Since Shankaracharya was born in a Nambudri family, this is somehow used to authenticate Shankara's association with the ashrama at Badari. Similarly, Mahadevan states that the priests at the temple in Thiruvottiyur in Tripura Sundari are Nambudris. This is Niyamadras. There are so many of these legends connected with Shankara that it is difficult to disentangle ritual action from his life history. Sri Chakra worship is highly esoteric, and if Shankara is associated with the Sri Chakra puja, one cannot find fault with the mathas finding legitimacy for their own ritual participation. Temples are sites of ritual, and a temple within the matha is a direct sanction for ritualistic activity, however much it may be explained euphemistically. We all know the story of the legend of Shankara going back and visiting his mother at her deathbed, and how he performed the cremation and things like that. Now, that is the last act of a sannyasin who's not allowed to do any kind. That is, I suppose, the last act. And that, again, opposed. People, his relatives even did not help him. Shankara also did not condemn karma and bhakti wholeheartedly, but allowed them as preliminary steps towards the purification of the mind in order to make the aspirant fit for knowledge, which thus led to the acceptance of rituals and particularly bhakti into the Advaita fold in an indirect way. Bhakti also involves a worshipper and the worshipped generally and brings to mind the temple setting. The attribution of many bhakti compositions to Shankara, who permits worship of a deity as a preliminary to jnana, did not help matters either. The uneasy juxtaposition of the separation of jnana for those who had renounced and the acceptance of karma, of karma or bhakti as preliminary steps for the purification of the mind was not helpful in getting rid of ritual completely from Advaita. While what happened within the ashramas was somehow accepted because of the association of the ashramas with Shankara, it was not that easy to accommodate the temple, which was a visible site of ritual outside the ashrama surroundings, as a place which can be visited by sannyasins within the Advaita definition. Different strategies had therefore to be adopted for that purpose, and one of them effectively channelized was the concept of Loka Sangraha. I alluded to Swami Bhumananda taking recourse to Loka Sangraha in order to justify his temple activities. Almost all the sannyasins of the Advaita Sampradaya I personally spoke to, like Swami Swarupananda, Jayendra Saraswati, Dayananda Saraswati et al., took recourse to the concept of Loka Sangraha whenever challenged to explain their association with rituals in a temple. Loka Sangraha is a new concept in Hinduism and is used for the first time in the Mahabharata, and the expression occurs twice in the Bhagavad Gita, on which Shankaracharya commented. In the case of a sannyasin's life, Loka Sangraha is a revolutionary concept, for it is interpreted as working for the welfare of the people or preventing people from going astray, and as such it goes against the instruction to abandon Lokaishana mentioned in the Upanishads. Even though some might say that Loka in Lokaishana in the Upanishad refers to the desire for the other worlds based on the rituals one performs, the very word Loka can easily be interpreted as the world one lives in, and that is the meaning one gets from the Mahabharata and the Gita. We might also argue for the meaning of the word Loka Sangraha to be construed as holding the world together, as is found in Mahabharata 12.259.26. This path of Loka Sangraha, by acting without any selfish motives, can achieve liberation just as much by abandoning one's dharma and assuming a mendicant's robe, says the Gita. The very definition of a sannyasin undergoes change in the Gita, coupled with a redefinition of karma itself as karma yoga. Thus, very often in order to make available the ultimate value of moksha for the one in the grihastha ashrama, there is also the caveat of dharma being done in a nishkama way, in which case that kind of a grihasthin is called a sannyasin and a niragnihi, satisfying the technical requirement of a sannyasin being without rituals, as well as doing karma not for his own sake, i.e. having vairagya or detachment from results for his personal gain. Traditionally, Shankara is not a philosopher, is not only a philosopher. I'll quickly go through that, I'll just summarize it. Shankaracharya is not only known as a philosopher, we all know that he also reformed religion. He's traditionally supposed to have reformed the many, there were at least 72 different cults which were floating around, as TMP Mahadevan says, and he brought all of them under six headings, and so he is also known as the Shanmata Sthapaka. So you cannot remove the idea that Shankaracharya also actively participated in reforming religion as well. So Shankaracharya also was one who worked for the welfare of the world in the sense of awakening the spiritual awareness of the people, both philosophically and religiously. Thus, when Advaitins of later times find no contradiction in their engaging in activities which are strictly pertaining to temples, they have no problem in using Shankara's own example as justifying their working for the welfare of the world. Thus, a large part of the activities of Swami Bhumananda, with whom we started this paper, as well as the performance of puja to Chandramaulishwara and Sharadamba by the Sringeri Jagatguru, as well as the participation of many other sannyasins of the Advaita Sampradaya in different activities within the temple, does find some authority in an indirect way. The sannyasins almost always point out that they do not do the rituals themselves, but are present at the ceremonies in order to set an example for others not to abandon the path of dharma, i.e. help others not to go astray. But is it possible to sustain this argument effectively? Maintaining their distance from doing the rituals themselves seems to just a technical detail. If the yajamana, by just being present in a Vedic sacrifice, is supposed to benefit from the performance of the Vedic rituals by the Ritvik, Advaryu, Udgatri and Brahman when the ritual is done, It becomes difficult to explain how by being present at the rituals, the Advaita Sannyasin can consider himself or herself removed from the results of the ritual act itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this very rich and learned paper, but unfortunately, because we've gone through the entire half hour, there won't be time for questions to follow, so we'll have to simply take up those questions with Professor Rukmini after the session is over.